before we start, I'd like to give a massive shout-out to the following people for supporting Stories Telling Stories on Patreon. Jim Ross, Holly, Tamara, Tom, Maddie, and Carrie. Thank you so much for your support. If you'd like to help grow the show and hear your name listed before future episodes, head on over to patreon.com/storiestellingstories. Horror as a media genre relies on the subterfuge of normality to achieve its goals. Drawing from basic fears derived over millions of years of human evolution and experience, the collective we learn to fear things that can, have, and indeed do cause harm to our person and our fellow humans. Things that creep in the darkness. Large teeth. Claws. Falling from great heights. Living things deceased, seemingly returning to this mortal coil. Things that suck our blood, eat our flesh, and stalk us relentlessly. But some of the greatest sources of suffering and fear are not external, and instead dwell within us. Disease, famine, illness, plague and pestilence. But none perhaps more fear-inducing than that exercised upon our consciousness by our own minds. The terror invoked by a towel draped over a chair in the dead of night. A pile of leaves come to life in vivid detail, injecting adrenaline into our bloodstreams as the fight-or-flight instinct takes over reasonable thought. The end of logic and reason, on the backbone of the will to survive. The masters of horror carefully crafted tales of mystery and mystique, tapping into subtle and abstract human fears, casting a wide net to invoke a response in the greatest number of people. But as all things do, the iconic tropes and ideas of generations past have worn down the intended response of an aging population, calling for even greater and grander ideas. Obscene and obscure tropes, trials and tribulations, and ridiculous effects to invoke the coveted response. Fear of the unknown has been usurped by the jump scare. Monsters of the mind have been pulled into ultra-high-definition focus, revealing all their secrets and leaving nothing to the imagination. The greatest source of horror and dread resides within the human mind, not within the instant gratification of an on-screen reveal, not with a character coming face-to-face with the object of their adversity, and not with a physical monster, regardless of how many tails, teeth, or tattered tears and blood-stained skin they may have. Stop showing us what to fear. Let the thing that goes bump do it in darkness. The horrors of the unknown corners of the unwilling mind are far greater, far darker, and far more personal than any personification of fear that could grace the stage, screen, or page. What would you do if this evil lived inside you? Unseen, unknown, an insidious disease so deadly and disastrous that it eradicated the majority of humanity in a matter of months. A pandemic with an unknown source and an unknown cure. A painless, but assuredly fatal condition that robbed your body of the very bones that held it together. And what would you do if you and your child were somehow immune, secret survivors of this condition, watching on as a population desperate for a cure is tearing apart others in search of a solution? Would you speak up and help, or resign yourself to becoming the last human beings on Earth? This is our story. Crafted by F. Paul Wilson, a contemporary master of modern horror and suspense whose work has appeared across print media for nearly 40 years. His story, Soft, tells the story of just such a pandemic that robs its victims of the calcium in their bones, turning a body into a puddle of muscle and mush in a matter of days. A condition with no cure and no immunity. Or so they thought. This is Soft by F. Paul Wilson on Locked in a Vacancy, STS Spooktober 2020. I was lying on the floor watching TV and exercising what was left of my legs when the newscaster's jaw collapsed. He was right in the middle of the usual plea for anybody who thought they were immune to come to Rockefeller Center when, plumpf, the bottom of his face went soft. I burst out laughing.
"Daddy,"
Judy said, shooting me a razor blade look from her wheelchair. I shut up. She was right. Nothing funny about a man's tongue wiggling around in the air snake-like, while his lower jaw flopped down in front of his throat like a sack of jello. His bottom teeth jutted at the screen, crowns on, rippling like a line of buoys on a bay. A year ago, I would have gagged. But I've changed in ways other than physical since this mess began, and I couldn't help feeling good about one of those pretty boy newsreaders going soft right in front of the camera. I almost wished I had a bigger screen so I could watch 21 color inches of the scene. He was barely visible on our 5-inch black and white. The room filled with white noise as the screen went blank. Someone must have taken a look at what was going on the airwaves and pulled the plug. Not that many people were watching anyway. I flipped the set off to save the batteries. Batteries were as good as gold now. Better than gold. Who wanted gold nowadays? I looked over at Judy, and she was crying softly. Tears slid down her cheeks. "Hey, hon."
"I can't help it, Daddy. I'm so scared."
"Don't be, Jude. Don't worry. Everything will work out, you'll see. We got this thing licked, you and me."
"How can you be so sure?"
"Because it hasn't progressed in weeks. It's over for us. We got immunity." She glanced down at her legs, then quickly away.
"It's already too late for me."
I reached over and patted my dancer on the hand. "Never too late for you, sweetheart," I said. That got a tiny smile out of her. We sat there in the silence, each thinking our own thoughts. The newsreader had said the cause of the softness had been discovered. A virus, a freak mutation that disrupted the calcium matrix of bones. Yeah, sure. That's what they said last year when the first cases cropped up in Boston. A virus. But they never isolated the virus, and the softness spread all over the world. So they began searching for a subtle and elusive environmental toxin. They never pinned that one down either. Now we're back to a virus. Who cared? Didn't matter. Judy and I had beaten it. Whether we had formed the right antibodies or the right antitoxin was just a stupid academic question. The process had been arrested in us. Sure, it had done some damage, but it wasn't doing any more, and that was the important thing. We'd never be the same, but we were going to live.
"But that man,"
Judy said, nodding towards the TV.
"He said they were looking for people in whom the disease had started and then stopped. That's us, Dad. They said they may need to examine people like us so they can find out how to fight it. Maybe develop a serum against it. We should..."
Judy, I said, trying to hide my annoyance. "How many times did I have to go over this with you? We've been through this before." "I told you. It's too late for them. Too late for everybody but us immunes." I didn't want to discuss it. Judy didn't understand about those kind of people, how you can't deal with them.
"I want you to take me down there,"
she said, in the tone that she used when she wanted to be stubborn.
"If you don't want to help, okay. But I do."
"No!" I said that louder than I wanted to, and she flinched. More softly, "I know these people. I worked all those years in the health department. They'd turn us into lab specimens. They'd suck us dry and use our immunity to try and save themselves."
"But I want to help somebody. I don't want us to be the last two people on Earth."
She began to cry again. Judy was frustrated. I could understand that. She was unable to leave the apartment by herself and probably saw me at times as a dictator who had her at his mercy. And she was frightened. Probably more frightened than I could imagine. She was only 18 and everyone else she had ever known in her life, including her mother, was dead. I hoisted myself into the chair next to her and put my arm around her shoulders. She was the only person in the world who mattered to me. That had been true even before the softness began. We're not alone. Take George, for example. And I'm sure there's plenty of other immunes around who are hiding, like us. When the weather warms up, we'll find each other and start everything over new. But until then, we can't allow the bloodsuckers to drain off whatever it is we've got that protects us. She nodded without saying anything. I wondered if she was agreeing with me or just trying to shut me up. Let's eat, I said with a gusto I didn't really feel.
Not hungry.
Gotta keep your strength up. We'll have soup. How does that sound? She smiled weakly.
Okay. Soup.
I forgot and almost tried to stand up. Old habits die hard. My lower legs were hanging over the edge of the chair like a pair of sand-filled dancer's tights. I could twitch the muscles and see them ripple under the skin, but a muscle's pretty useless unless it's attached to a bone. And the bones down there were gone. I slipped off my chair to what was left of my knees and shuffled over to the stove. The feel of those limp and useless leg muscles squishing under me was repulsive. But I was getting used to it. It hit the kids and the old people first, supposedly because their bones were a little soft to begin with, and then moved on to the rest of us, starting at the bottom and working its way up. Sort of like a Horatio Alger success story. At least, that's the way it worked in most people. There were exceptions, of course, like that newscaster. I had followed true to form. My left lower leg collapsed at the end of last month. My right one a few days later. It wasn't a terrible shock. My feet had already gone soft, so I knew the legs were next. Besides, I had heard the sound. The sound comes in the night when all is quiet. It starts a day or two before a bone goes. A soft sound, like someone gently crinkling cellophane inside your head. No one else can hear it, only you. I think it comes from the bone itself, from millions of tiny fractures slowly interconnecting into a mosaic that eventually causes the bone to dissolve into mush. Like an onrushing train far, far away can be heard if you press your ear to the track. So the sound of each microfracture transmits from bone to bone until it reaches your middle ear. I haven't heard the sound in almost 4 weeks. I thought I did a couple of times and broke out in a cold shaking sweat, but no more of my bones have gone. Neither have Judy's. The average case goes from normal person to lump of jelly in 3 to 4 weeks. Sometimes it takes longer, but there's always a steady progression. Nothing more has happened to me or Judy since last month. Somehow, some way, we're immune. With my lower legs dangling behind me, I got to the counter of the kitchenette and kneaded my way up to the step stool where I could reach things. I filled a pot with water, at least the pressure's still up, and set it on the Sterno stove. With gas and electricity long gone, Sterno was a lifesaver. While waiting for the water to boil, I went to the window and looked out. The late afternoon March sky was full of dark gray clouds streaking to the east. Nothing moving on West 16th Street, one floor below us, but a few stubborn leaves from God knows where. I glanced across the windows at George's apartment, looking for movement, but found none. Then back down to the street below. I hadn't seen anybody but George on the street for ages. Hadn't seen or smelled smoke in well over 2 months. The last fires must have finally burned themselves out. The riots were one result of the viral theory. Half the city went up in the big riot last fall. Half the city and an awful lot of people. Seems someone got the bright idea that if all the people going soft were put out of their misery and their bodies burned, the plague could be stopped, at least here in Manhattan. The few cops left couldn't stop the mobs. In fact, a lot of the city's ex-cops had been in the mobs. Judy and I lost our apartment when our building went up. Luckily, we hadn't had any signs of softness then. We got away with our lives, little else.
Water's boiling, Dad,
she said from across the room. I turned and went back to the stove, not saying anything. Still thinking about how fast our nice rent-stabilized apartment house had burned. Taking everything we had with it. Everything gone. Furniture and futures, gone. All my plans, gone. Here I stood. If you could call it that. A man with a college education. A BS in biology, a secure city job, and what was left? No job. Hell, no city. I had it all planned for my dancer. She was going to make it so big. I'd hang on to my city job with those civil service idiots in the health department, putting up with their sniping and their backstabbing and their lousy office politics so I could keep all the benefits and foot the bill while Judy pursued the dance. She was going to have it all. Now what? All her talent. All her potential. Where was it going? Going soft. I poured the dry contents of the Lipton envelope into the boiling water, and soon the odor of chicken noodle soup filled the room, which meant we'd soon have company. I dragged the step stool over to the door. Already I could hear their claws begin to scrape against the outer surface of the door. Their tiny teeth began to gnaw at its edges. I climbed up and peered through the hole I'd made last month at what had then been eye level. There they were. The landing was full of them. Gray and brown and dirty, with glinty little eyes and naked tails. Revulsion rippled down my skin. I watched their growing numbers every day, every time I cooked something, but still hadn't got used to them. So I did Cagney for them. You doity rats! And I turned to wink at Judy on the far side of the fold-out bed. Her expression remained grim. Rats. They were taking over the city. They seemed to be immune to the softness and were traveling in packs that got bigger and bolder with each passing day. Which is why I'd chosen this building for us. Each apartment was boxed in with pre-stressed concrete block. No rats in the walls here. I waited for the inevitable. Soon it happened. A number of them squealed, screeched, and thrashed as the crowding pushed them at each other's throats. And then there was bedlam out there. I didn't bother to watch anymore. I saw it every day. The pack jumped on the wounded ones and never failed. They were so hungry they'd eat anything, even each other. And while they were fighting amongst themselves, they'd leave us in peace with our soup. Soon I had the card table between us, and we were sipping yellow broth and those tiny noodles. I did a lot of gooding, but got no response from Judy. Her eyes were fixed on the walkie-talkie on the end table.
How come we haven't heard from him?
Good question. One that had been bothering me for a couple days now. Where was George? Usually he stopped by every other day to see if we needed anything. And if he didn't stop by, he'd call us on the walkie-talkie. We had an arrangement. And we both turn on our headsets every day at 6 p.m. Just in case we needed to be in touch. I've been calling over to George's place across the street at 6 o'clock sharp for 3 days running now and no result. He's probably wandering about the city, seeing what he can pick up. He's a resourceful guy. Probably come back with something we can really use but haven't thought of. Judy didn't flash me the anticipated smile. Instead, she frowned.
What if he went down to the research center?
I'm sure he didn't. He's a trusting soul, but he's not a fool. I kept my eyes down as I spoke. I'm not a good liar. and that very question had been nagging at my gut. What if George had been stupid enough to present himself to the researchers? If he had, he was through. They'd never let him go, and we'd never see him again. For George wasn't immune like us. He was different. Judy and I had caught the virus, or toxin, and defeated it. We were left with terrible scars from the battle, but we survived. We acquired our immunity through battle with the softness agent. George was special. He had remained untouched. He'd exposed himself to infected people for months, and he helped everyone he could, and it was still hard all over. Not so much as a little toe had gone soft on him. Which meant, to me at least, that George had been born with some sort of immunity to the softness. Wouldn't those researchers love to get their needles and scalpels into him? I wonder if they had. George might have been picked up and brought down to the research center against his will. He once told me he'd seen official-looking vans and cars prowling the streets, driven by guys wearing gas masks or the like. That had been months ago, and he hadn't reported anything like it since. Certainly no cars had been on this street in recent memory. I warned him time and time again about roaming in the daylight, but he always laughed good-naturedly and said nobody'd ever catch him. He was too fast. What if he'd run into someone faster? Only one thing to do. I'm going to take a stroll over to George's, just to see if he's okay. Judy gasped.
No, Dad, you can't. It's too far.
It's only across the street.
But your legs
are only half gone. I'd met George shortly after the last riot. I had two hard legs then. I'd come looking for a sturdier building than the one we'd been burned out of. He helped us move in here. I was suspicious at first, I admit that. I mean, I kept asking myself, what does this guy want? Turns out he only wanted to be friends. So friends we became. He was soon the only other man I trusted in this whole world. And that being the case, I wanted a gun, for protection against all those other men I didn't trust. George told me he had stolen a bunch during the early lootings. I traded him some Sterno and batteries for a .38 and a pump-action 12-gauge shotgun, with ammo for both. I promptly sawed off the barrel of the shotgun. If the need arose, I could clear a room real fast with that baby. So it was the shotgun I reached for now. No need to fool with it. I kept his chamber empty and the magazine loaded with number 5 shells. I laid it on the floor and reached into the rag bag beside the door and began tying old undershirts around my knees. Maybe I shouldn't call them knees. With the lower legs and caps gone, knee hardly seemed appropriate. From there, it was a look through the peephole to make sure the hall was clear. A blown kiss to Judy, then a shuffle into the hall. I was extra wary at first, ranging the landing up and down and looking for rats, but there weren't any in sight. I slung the shotgun around my neck, letting it hang in front as I started down the stairs, one by one on hand and butt, knees first, each flabby lower leg dragging alongside its respective thigh. 2 flights down to the lobby, then up on my padded knees to the swinging door. A hard push through, and I was on the street. Silence. We kept our windows tightly closed against the cold, and so I hadn't noticed the change. Now, it hit me like a slap in the face. As a lifelong New Yorker, I never heard the city like this. Make that not heard. Even when there'd been nothing doing on your street, you could always hear that dull roar pulsing from the sky and the pavement and the walls of the buildings. The life sound of the city. The beating of its heart. The whisper of its breath. The rush of blood through its capillaries. It had stopped. The shiver that ran over me was not just March wind's sharp edge. The street was deserted. A plague had been through here. But no contorted bodies were strewn about. You didn't fall down and die on the spot with the softness. No, that would be too kind. You died by inches, by bone lengths, in back rooms, trapped, unable to make it to the street, no public displays of morbidity. Just solitary deaths of quiet desperation. In a secret way, I was glad everyone was gone. Nobody around to see me tooling across the sidewalk on my rag-wrapped knees like some Skid Row geek. The city looked different from down here. When you have legs to stand on, you never realize how cracked the sidewalks are. How dirty. The buildings, their windows glaring red with the setting sun that had poked through clouds over New Jersey, looked half again as high as they were when I was a taller man. I shuffled to the street and caught myself looking both ways before sliding off the curb. I smiled at the thought of getting run down by a truck on my first trip in over a month, across a street that probably hadn't seen the underside of a car since December. Despite the absurdity of it, I hurried across, and felt relief when I finally reached the far curb. Pulling open the damn doors to George's apartment building was a chore, but I slipped through both of them and was into the lobby. George's bike, a light-frame Italian model 10-speed, was there. I didn't like that. George took that bike everywhere. Of course, he could have found a car and some gas and gone sightseeing and not told me. But the sight of that bike standing there made me uneasy. I shuffled by the silent bank of elevators, watching my longing expression reflected in their silent, immobile chrome doors. The fire door to the stairwell was a heavy one, but I squeezed through and started up the steps. Backwards. Maybe there was a better way, but I hadn't found it. It was all in the arms. Sit on the bottom step, get your arms back, palms down on the step above, lever yourself up. Repeat this 10 times, you've gone a flight of stairs. 2 flights per floor. Thank the Lord or whatever that George had decided he preferred a second floor apartment to a penthouse after the final power failure. It was a good thing I was going up backward. I'd never have seen the rats if I'd been facing around the other way. Just one appeared at first, alone. It was almost cute with its twitching whiskers and its head bobbing up and down as it sniffed the air at the bottom of the flight. Then 2 more joined in, then another 6. Soon they were a brown wave undulating up the steps towards me. I hesitated for an instant, horrified and fascinated by their numbers and their little black eyes sweeping towards me. Then I jolted myself into action. I swung the scattergun around, pumped a shell into the chamber, and let them have a blast. Dimly through the reverberating roar of the shotgun, I heard a chorus of squeals and saw flashes of flying crimson blossoms. Then I was ducking my face into my arms to protect my eyes from the ricocheting shot. I should have realized the danger of shooting into a cinderblock stairwell like this. Not that it would have changed things. I still had to protect myself. But I should have anticipated the ricochets. The rats did what I hoped they'd do. Jumped on the dead and near dead of their number and forgot all about me. I let the gun hang in front of me again and continued up the stairs to George's floor. He didn't answer his bell, but the door was unlocked. I'd warned him about that in the past, but he'd only laughed in that carefree way of his.
"Who's gonna pop in?" he'd say.
Probably no one. That didn't keep me from locking mine, even though George was the only one who knew where I lived. I wonder if that meant I really didn't trust George. I put the question aside and pushed the door open. It stank inside, and it was empty as far as I could see. But there was this sound, this wheezing, coming from one of the bedrooms. Calling his name and announcing my own so I wouldn't get my head blown off, I closed the door behind me, locked it, and followed the sound. I found George, and retched. George was a blob of flesh in the middle of his bed. Everything but some ribs, and some of his facial bones, and the back of his skull had gone soft on him. I stood there on my knees in shock, wondering how this could have happened. George was immune. He'd laughed at the softness. He'd be walking around as good as new just last week, and now...
Oh, his lips were dry and cracked, and blue. He couldn't speak, couldn't swallow, could barely breathe. And his eyes, they seemed to just be floating there in a quivering pool of flesh, begging me, darting to his left again and again, begging me. For what? I looked to his left and saw the guns. He had a suitcase full of them by the bedroom door. All kinds. I picked up a heavy-looking revolver, Smith & Wesson 357, glanced at him. He closed his eyes, and I thought he smiled. I almost dropped the pistol when I realized what he wanted. No, George! He opened his eyes again. They began to fill with tears. George! I can't! Something like a sob bubbled past his lips. In his eyes. His pleading eyes. I stood there for a long time in the stink of his bedroom, listening to him wheeze, feeling the sweat collect between my palms and the pistol grip. I knew I couldn't do it. Not George. The big, friendly, good-natured slob I'd been depending on. Suddenly, I felt my pity begin to evaporate as a flare of irrational anger began to rise. I'd been depending on George now that my legs were half gone. And here he'd gone soft on me. The bitter disappointment fueled the anger. I knew it wasn't right, but I couldn't help hating George just then for letting me down. Damn you, George! I raised the pistol and pointed it where I thought his brain should be. I turned my head away and pulled the trigger. Twice. The pistol jumped in my hand. The sound was deafening in the confines of the bedroom. Then all was quiet, except for the ringing in my ears. George wasn't wheezing anymore. I didn't look around. I didn't have to see. I have a good imagination. I fled that apartment as fast as my ruined legs would carry me. But I couldn't escape the vision of George and how he looked before I shot him. It haunted me every inch of the way home, down the now empty stairs where only a few tufts of dirty brown fur were left to indicate the rats had been swarming there, out into the dusk and across the street and up more stairs to home. George. How could it be? He was immune. Or was he? Maybe the softness had followed a different course in George, slowly building up in his system until every bone in his body was riddled with it, and then he went soft all at once. God, what a noise he must have heard when all those bones went in one shot. That's why he hadn't been able to call or answer the walkie-talkie. But what if it had been something else? What if the virus theory was right and George was the victim of a more vicious mutation? The thought made me sick with dread. Because if that were true, it meant Judy would eventually end up like George. And I was going to have to do for her what I'd done for George. But what of me then? Who was going to end it for me? I didn't know if I had the guts to shoot myself. And what if my hands went soft before I had the chance? I didn't want to think about it. But it wouldn't go away. I couldn't remember ever being so frightened. I almost considered going down to Rockefeller Center and presenting Judy and myself to the leechers. Kill that idea real quick. Never. I'm no jerk.
I'm college educated, a degree in biology. I know what they do to us. Inside, Judy had wheeled her chair over to the door and was waiting for me. I couldn't let her know. Not there, I told her before she could ask, and busied myself with putting the shotgun away so I wouldn't have to look her straight in the eyes.
Where could he be?
Her voice was tight. I wish I knew. Maybe he went down to Rockefeller Center. If he did, it's the last we'll ever see of him.
I can't believe that.
Then tell me where else he could be. She was silent. I could see that I failed. She was silent. I decided to change the subject was in order. I'm tired. It was the truth. My trip across the street had been exhausting.
Me too.
She yawned. Want to get some sleep? I knew she did. I was just staying a step or two ahead of her so she wouldn't have to ask to be put to bed. She was a dancer. A fine, proud artist. Judy would never have to ask anyone to put her to bed, not while I was around. As long as I was able, I would spare her the indignity of dragging herself across the floor. I gathered Judy up in my arms. The whole lower half of her body was soft. Her legs hung over my left arm like weighted drapes. It was all I could do to keep from crying when I felt them so limp and formless. My dancer. You should have seen her in Swan Lake. Her legs had been so strong. So sleekly muscular. Like her mother's. I took her to the bathroom and left her alone, which left me alone with my daymares. What if there really was a mutation of the softness, and my dancer began leaving me again? Slowly, inch by inch. What was I gonna do when she was gone? My wife was gone. My folks were gone. What few friends I'd ever had were gone. Judy was the only attachment I had left. Without her, I'd break loose from everything and just float off into space. I needed her. When she was finished in the bathroom, I carried her out and arranged her on the bed. I tucked her in and kissed her goodnight. Out in the living room, I slipped under the covers of the fold-out bed and tried to sleep. Useless. The fear wouldn't leave me alone. I fought it, telling myself that George was a freak case. That Judy and I had licked the softness. We were immune, and we'd stay immune. Let everyone else turn into puddles of jello. I wasn't going to let them suck us dry to save themselves. We were on our way to inheriting the Earth, Judy and I. And we didn't have to be meek about it. But still, sleep refused to come. So I lay there in the growing darkness, in the center of the silent city, and listened. Listened as I did every night, as I knew I would listen for the rest of my life. Listen for that sound. That cellophane crinkling sound. The end.
Locked in a Vacancy is produced in collaboration with Stories Telling Stories and STS Media Group, socially isolating itself at Milt House Studios in Milton, Vermont, casting around the globe to your frontal lobe wherever podcasts are found. Locked in a Vacancy is also streaming on YouTube at Stories Telling Stories. Make sure to give us a review wherever you stream our show. We really appreciate it. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Give us a subscribe on YouTube and consider supporting us on Patreon for as little as a dollar a month. And until next time, stay sane, stay safe, stay spooky, and stay whimsical. Thank you.